engine 3, engine 13 company, engine 6 is RIT, engine 17, truck 17 of battalion 1, structure fire 528 Magnolia Street near Eagle Lane to be channel 4. Engine 3, engine 13 company, engine 6 is RIT, engine 17, truck 17 of battalion 1, structure fire 528 Magnolia Street near Eagle Lane. It's going to be a two-story apartment building. Reported people are inside. Channel 4.
Hi, I'm Joe Pernesti. Welcome to this edition of Main Street Firefighting on Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. That dispatch you just heard took place in the mid-afternoon of Sunday, January 26, 2014, in the city of Toledo, Ohio. The fire ended up taking the lives of two brave firefighters. And it really was a fire that many people know about in my neck of the woods in Ohio, but I'm not really sure how many know across the country. And this fire took the lives of firefighter Steven Machinsky and Jamie Dickman. Toledo Fire Department has done a wonderful job in sharing their lessons. And today you will hear from a chief from Toledo who wrote or helped write the internal investigation report. And as a student of the fire service, and I'm sure many of you listening to this can attest that we read a lot of line of duty death reports, NIOSH reports, and we should. The difference is that many departments, after those are written, just go about things and don't utilize them to actually change. Or worse yet, they sweep the event under the carpet and that's it. Toledo didn't do that. And I'm very, very happy that we had an opportunity to speak with Chief Mike Benedum. I'm sure you will enjoy it. And he gives his contact information. So at the end and also on the Blog Talk Radio website, there will be links to the report and to contact Chief Benedum. But I encourage you to reach out to him. This podcast doesn't do service to what you can learn from the chief and from the actual presentation. So without further ado, Chief Mike Benedum, Toledo Fire. Okay, we are here with Chief Mike Benedum from the Toledo Fire Department. Chief, I want to first off thank you for being on my show tonight. And I really want to say to our listeners that if you get a chance to, you know, we have so many line of duty death reports that we can look at that you can access for your training or for your own personal development and growth. But Chief Benedum has put a personal touch on it with his presentations. And I encourage you, and at the end of this, we will give Chief's information out that you can contact him. But I think there's something that really enhances learning when you can have a voice and to listen or watch a presentation from someone who, again, was intimate with this. In fact, Chief Benedum is one of the authors of the internal after-action review of this fire. So, Chief, without further ado, I want to again thank you. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Chief. First of all, the privilege is all mine on behalf of the Toledo Fire Rescue Department, Chief Bird, and my direct supervisor, Chief John Kaminsky. We are very, very grateful to have this opportunity to share our story with you. A little bit of background on myself. I've been in the fire service for 37 years. I've been with the Toledo Fire Rescue Department for 26 of those years. Started out as a volunteer in my hometown, the Allen Clay Joint Fire District. Retired out of there in 2015 as an assistant battalion chief. I've been a fire instructor since 2000, paramedic since 1987. I'm on the serious injury line of duty death response team here that we've created, and I've been a member of the Lucas County, Ohio, and Toledo Fire Chiefs Association for about a year and a half. Had an opportunity to work in our training bureau. I just came back there the first of this year as battalion chief. I was here previously for 4 years as captain. I've worked in our Bureau of Professional Standards, and I was captain of operations for about a year and served on the line for many years before that.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about the Toledo Fire Department for anybody who isn't quite up on Toledo's Fire Department. How many personnel, stations, that kind of thing?
Sure. The city of Toledo is in northwest Ohio. It sits right on Lake Erie at the Michigan border. It's a city that makes up 86 square miles. We have a population of just shy of 300,000 people. Our fire department is obviously career. We have an authorized strength of 525 career members. We currently have 110 members on duty per day. In 2014, when this incident occurred, our authorized strength at that time on the line was 103. We operate out of 19 fire stations. We have 18 engine companies, 3 tower ladders, 2 heavy rescues, 6 what we call life squads. Those are ALS transport units, 10 rescue transports, which are basic life support. We also have a fireboat, 2 dive boats, 5 technical rescue units, which make up confined space, trench, rescue, hazmat, USAR and water rescue, and then we have 3 line battalion chiefs. The city's divided into 3 battalions. There's 1 battalion chief on duty in each of those battalions 24 hours a day.
Okay, and let's go ahead and set the stage for, again, some of our listeners may not know anything as far as the line and what took place. Let's go ahead and begin what happened on that cold January 26th morning in 2014.
Yeah, so it was a Sunday. Actual incident was dispatched at about 2:46 in the afternoon. It was a cloudy, overcast day. We had quite a bit of snow and ice on the ground. The call was dispatched as an apartment fire with people, plural, still in the building. And essentially, we had our station 3 was literally one city block away from this incident. But at the time of this incident, station 3 was closed for a complete renovation. So they had been relocated to one of our stations on the east side of the Maumee River opposite of where this fire was. So one of the first things that occurred there was we had a delayed response because of the relocation of that company. And when companies were responding, as they responded in, there were numerous different companies on the incident that would not normally be on the running order because several of the closest companies, one was relocated and several others were on other EMS incidents at the time. So we came from a distance. As we responded in, the battalion chief responding did see a fairly large column of smoke off in the direction of the fire. He radioed that to the incoming crews. They looked for it as they responded, didn't necessarily see what he saw. He reported that again a short time later. And it was a large column of smoke under pressure. And when we turned onto the street that the incident was on and the initial arriving companies, several of them arrived simultaneously. The battalion chief, engine 3, which our 2 members were on, and engine company 13, they all basically arrived at the same time. As they pulled up to the incident, what they found was a fairly large complex on the intersection of Magnolia and Huron Street. It consisted of the Huron Market with apartments above, and then the actual fire building was attached to the market, but there was no connection between the fire building and the market. It was walled off. When they arrived and laid first eyes on the building, they saw smoke that was significantly different than the chief observed while he was en route. What they basically, all of those arriving members stated they saw was a lot of thick gray, brown, white smoke. All of the smoke that they observed was coming from Division 2. The smoke was described, like I said, as white, gray, brown, billowing, seeping smoke, nothing that was threatening to them. What they knew was that we had a serious working fire. All of the smoke, they said, was again from Division 2. They didn't observe any smoke or fire on Division 1, and there was no visible fire initially. So based on their initial observations, it looked to them like it was a Division 2 fire. They came up to the intersection. We generally will try to see three sides of the building on our typical bread and butter house fire. Our first due engine generally will pull past a house so that the officer can see three sides of the building before he or she steps off the rig. And that's what we did here. And when we pulled around onto Huron Street, we saw the same type of conditions. There was a significant amount of gray billowy smoke coming from Division 2. We are operating with that added sense of urgency that we always have. I'm still thinking that there are multiple people still in the building. There was a small apartment, one floor apartment, between the fire building and the market that attached the two buildings. We initially made entry there thinking and looking for that there would be an interior stairwell leading to Division 2.
That was on the first floor, correct? That small apartment you were talking about?
Yeah, that apartment was a first floor apartment only, and there was a walk-in door there. So they were hoping to find a stairwell to Division 2 or the fire building. When they entered that building, it was a very small apartment that they immediately recognized was a dead end. It didn't lead to either the market or the fire building, so they exited. At that point, the battalion chief and the company officer decided, due to the size of the building or the complex, that the best next option for entry was to ladder the Division 2 window of the fire building and make entry in that window. So crews immediately laddered that. There were two garage doors directly below that window. Engine Company 3 firefighter Dickman, he was the first one up the ladder. He went up the ladder with a dry hose line and hand tools, got up. He took out the window. Gray billowing type smoke exited the window. Again, didn't see anything that was immediately threatening to us. He entered the window, and basically he went to the right, followed the wall, immediately met the Delta wall. He followed that towards Side Charlie. And firefighter Mashinsky then went up the ladder in the window and followed him, helping him advance the line. The company officer then went up the window, or up the ladder in the window. He stayed right inside the window and was assisting in advancing the line from that point. Engine Company 13, they were assigned search and backup. They went to the garage doors, and they found the right garage door was locked. The left garage door was unlocked. They opened it, made entry. It was very, very cluttered with all kinds of things, and they had some smoke at the ceiling, and they could see a small amount of fire on what would be the Charlie wall of the garage. They quickly cleared the garage in a primary search and recognized that there was fire behind that wall. As the line was being advanced, they were...
So this garage, and I want to encourage, this is why for our listeners, I really loved having Chief Benedum on, and will continue to try to have members that have written reports or been a part of serious events like this on, is that they can give their personal take to it. But it's very important to try to look at the pictures of this building. And one thing, Chief, that I see when I look at this building was it was kind of unusual based on what, you know, Toledo and Elyria are somewhat, as far as building stock, are the same. I mean, old, ordinary constructed buildings. But this one seemed a little different in the fact that you had this garage with an apartment above. Was this wall that you're talking about, did this kind of split the garage in two, like in half? Or try to help our listeners a little bit, myself too. I mean, as far as this, the garage, as far as it being split, when you say they couldn't get on the other side.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm going to try to lay out just the fire building for you that I've now described and we've entered into. When you look at side alpha, which is the Huron Street side of the building, you have the single window, which we made entry on. Again, the two garage doors below. And that garage was fairly small. It was a two-bay garage, one room. The back wall that I'm describing was a wall that divided the garage from a single apartment behind it.
Okay, and that was the apartment that you guys initially went to on Division One off the alley, correct?
No. It's really hard to describe. When you look at the pictures in the report, there's a two streets. Magnolia ends up being the Delta side of the structure, the way we set up our fire ground, and the Huron Street side, which is side alpha, where the garage doors are.
Okay.
On the Charlie Delta corner, there is a stone parking lot that is actually resides next to the market or right off of the Charlie Delta corner of our fire building.
Okay.
So that's I guess the best picture I can draw for you. Okay. And that the back wall of the garage did not completely butt up against the ceiling, which is what allowed the fire was set in the garage. It was an arson fire. It was set in the garage against the Charlie wall. The fire rapidly went up to the ceiling, and then because the wall didn't completely meet the ceiling, it went right into the apartment behind the garage.
Okay.
And as that fire progressed, there was two occupants in that apartment, and the female occupant was lying on her bed watching television right on the other side of that back garage wall. She almost immediately saw the smoke and the fire coming over her head. That's when she alerted her co-occupant, and they evacuated and called 911.
Okay.
And that fire then traveled in the Division One cock loft. It got into on the Charlie side of that apartment on Division One, there was a illegal addition. And I say illegal because there were no permits for the addition, a wood frame addition that was put on the back of this type, of construction. And it was very shoddy work. It had a shed roof on it. The fire quickly gained control of that addition. Because of the shed roof, it directed the flames directly up into the Division II cock loft. So basically, when we arrived and entered, what we actually had was a Division I apartment behind the garage that was fully involved. The illegal addition on the back was fully involved. The cock loft on Division II was also heavily involved. The fire simply hadn't broken out of the building yet.
Okay.
So when we entered, the reality is we entered above a very serious working fire. And when we were advancing to side Charlie on Division 2, we thought we had a Division 2 fire only because we had not completely ruled out fire on Division 1 before we made entry.
Okay.
And that was partially out of the rush to get in and search for the victims that we thought were trapped in the building.
Let me ask you about the victims now. When you got that call, and you may have already touched on this, but who said that there would be that there were people? Did the caller? How many reports of people people trapped in the building? Did just the initial 911 call, or did people tell that to the crews arriving?
No, that was given to our 911 call taker. The question was asked if there were still people in the building. It was, as I remember it, the dispatch or the 911 call taker asked if there were still people in the building, okay. And the caller said yes.
Okay. Okay.
And that's how it ended up being dispatched. On our arrival, shortly after we make entry and start advancing the hose line on Division 2, an occupant, the Division 2 apartment occupant, because Division 2 was an apartment also, a single apartment, mm-hmm. Basically one big room with a kitchen and bathroom on site, Charlie, came up to the incident commander, pointed basically up to Division 2 and said that everyone was out of the building and that the fire was in his kitchen.
Okay.
Which further convinced the incident commander that the fire was a rapidly expanding room and contents on Division 2.
Okay.
And at that point, we don't have any distress calls. Everything is going as planned. And we continue to advance and, you know, confirm that report by continuing the primary search.
When you guys, okay, and let me go back to the initial stretch. Now, again, we'll say it probably multiple times in our talk here that it really does help our listeners, if they're when they're listening to this, that they look at the report sometime and kind of put everything together. But when they stretched a line, was the first line the line up the into the window, or was the line that went up on the second floor in that side doorway off those stairs, was that the first line stretched?
No, the very first line stretched would have been the line that was up up the ladder and into the window.
Okay.
Engine company 13, who was assigned search and backup, stretched a second line into the garage.
Okay.
And then a subsequent arriving company on the first alarm was engine 6. They were assigned attack from the back of the building.
Okay.
What they ended up doing was backing into the stone parking lot off the Charlie Delta corner. And on the Delta side of the fire building, there was a Division 1 and Division 2 walk-in doors to each apartment.
Okay.
The Division 2 apartment door had an outside stairwell with wooden railing that led up to it, and there was a landing right outside that door. So Engine 6, what they did is backed into that parking lot. They stretched their attack line up the stairwell to the Division 2 Delta door.
Okay.
And that consisted of a screen door and a solid core interior door. The screen door, as you looked at it, opened from left to right. They opened that. The interior solid core door was slightly ajar, and there was a fairly significant amount of gray smoke coming out of that as well. And as they prepared their entry, they opened that solid core door. And very, very shortly after they opened that door, is when conditions changed very rapidly for the worse.
Okay.
The smoke increased, the color of the smoke darkened, and it rapidly went to pre-flash over light smoke. So if you can bear with me, I'll try to walk you through
sure.
What Engine 3. So essentially, at this point, we have two attack crews on Division 2. Engine 3 has entered over the ladder,
mm-hmm.
Into the window, from Site Alpha, and the other attack crew is Engine 6, and they are going to enter on Division 2 Site Delta.
Mm-hmm.
Both have an 1¾-inch hand line. Both are advancing those lines dry. We have always trained and insisted that those lines be charged as conditions dictate. They chose to enter dry because, quite honestly, it's faster and easier to advance. And
let me ask you on that, on the dry stretching. That is something that is typical of Toledo Fire, right? That you would do that for a second floor fire. So, you know, residential dwelling, bedroom fire, you normally would stretch a dry line up the second floor or up the stairs, say charge it, and away you go, correct?
Yeah, that's been a fairly common practice here for a long, long time.
Okay.
And we obviously have always encouraged anytime conditions are serious or if we are entering a building that we think that there's going to be immediate fire, that should be charged. But their sense was that it was a room and contents fire initially on Division 2, and that rescue was a top priority, so they were trying to advance very quickly, and they did that. They did do that dry on both lines.
Okay. Was there any thought, okay, and before we get to the emergency and when you take us there, how long, just so we put some added emphasis on it, how long after engine 13 stretched to that window did conditions appear to the battalion to be going bad?
So we, I can get to the, I'm looking at our timeline here. We arrived, it was dispatched at 1446. I believe we arrived at 1452. It was probably within 2 minutes or so after we initially made entry in the window that conditions started to rapidly deteriorate.
Okay.
Let's see.
And when it rapidly deteriorated, you basically had two crews in the building.
Correct. Engine 3 was still advancing towards Side Charlie, and Engine 6 had just made entry on Side Delta Division 2.
Okay. So when this goes bad, let's go to the emergency. Our listeners know now they have two lines in service, one up a ladder in a window, second one on Division 2 through a set of exterior stairs into a side door of the apartment. So let's go to the first signs of an emergency taking place.
Okay, so as Engine 3 is advancing that line towards Site Charlie, Engine 6 opens the door, conditions rapidly deteriorate. We had a rookie firefighter on the nozzle and an acting officer behind him. They recognized the conditions and chose to continue to advance into the building. When they made, just as the nozzle firefighter made entry, firefighter Dickman and firefighter Mashinsky became visible to him. They were crawling rapidly past him, and they came off of the Delta wall and went towards the center of the room. We don't know why they did that. We believe that they probably were seeing the glow and were chasing it. It was a surprise encounter. Engine 6's crew at that moment, in the stress of the situation, did not understand that there was another crew in the building. They reported that they saw another crew on Division 2 to the incident commander. There wasn't a response. There was no physical or verbal contact between the two crews. So Engine 6 had called for water. Some of the other issues, we had a rookie on the pump panel, and it was his first working fire. They got water, but it was not sufficient, but they continued in. What they did when they made entry in Division 2 there is made a right and followed the Delta wall.
Okay.
So I'll pause that for a second, go back to Engine 3. Firefighter Dickman and Firefighter Mashinsky are now somewhere in the center rear of the room. The company officer is back by the window. He's done feeding hose. He turns and he goes to crawl up to his firefighters, gets a couple crawls into it, and is rapidly, immediately driven to the floor by a huge blast of heat from above. And he's a very experienced inner city engine company officer, been to lots and lots of fires. He was driven to the floor, gets to the floor, looks up, and he has a fairly large fire front over his head.
Okay.
That's when he called for water. We had an excellent pump operator in Engine 3, sent the water immediately. It went to the nozzle without incident. As soon as the officer called for the water, he scrambled up to the line, up to the nozzle. When he arrived, everybody was down, and there was the fire front that was above them is now still above them, but coming down on them, and things are very hot.
Okay.
So I'll try to pause there, go back to engine six. While all of that's occurring with engine three, engine six has advanced on the delta wall. They have a glow in front of them. Both said that it was extremely hot at that point. They had some water. They opened the nozzle and they hit the glow in front of them. They said that the glow disappeared. Things sizzled really, really loud. And the only difference was conditions didn't improve, they worsened. The heat level was reported to rapidly increase. They were also hearing loud, heavy crashing sounds to their left. And the officer from engine three also reported similar sounds in front of him. We know now that that was most likely the collapse of the false ceiling in the room, as well as the Charlie wall, which would have divided the living space they were in and the kitchen and the floor. The floor in front of engine three was also collapsing.
Wow.
So we believe that's what those loud sounds were. And of course, as the floor and the wall collapsed, everything behind that wall and everything below them was on fire.
Okay.
And so back to engine three, the fire front's coming down on them. They're on the ground. Firefighter Dickman is on the nozzle. The lieutenant yells to him to put some water on the fire. He opens the nozzle on the ceiling, and it is at that moment that the hostile fire event occurred. Everything lit up. To the best of our investigation, at that point, firefighter Dickman slammed the nozzle shut. He was the first one to scream a mayday. And at this moment, the officer from engine 13, who had been assigned to back up and search on division one in the garage, he had gone up the ladder and was at the window, and being an oriented firefighter for the crews.
Okay.
As these conditions rapidly deteriorated, heavy black smoke and some fire came out of that window. He started yelling for them to exit the structure. When the actual event occurred, he believes that he heard someone inside running towards him, which would have been back towards side alpha. Mm-hmm. And as he, the blast of heat blows out that window. Now, he was in full PPE with his mask on. As the superheated conditions blow out that window, they damaged his face piece. Okay. He wasn't injured, but it was so hot. He said it was so hot through his bunker gear at the window on the ladder that he had to back down the ladder. As he backed down the ladder, he remembered hearing a short, loud hiss and a pop just to his left, which would have been in the Alpha Bravo corner of Division 2.
Mm-hmm.
We concluded that that was likely firefighter Dickman's SCBA failing, because it's our belief that firefighter Dickman, after screaming the initial mayday, he stood up and he ran back towards the window, which was his likely only known point of egress.
Okay.
He ends up running into a bed that was in the Alpha Bravo corner. And at that point, it's pretty difficult to discern on the radio traffic, but he did transmit one more screaming mayday, and that is where he essentially died. That's where he was located in the RIT search, was up in that corner.
Okay, so at that point, the mayday has been called. Dickman is trying, or has attempted to get out. Where the engine officer is back down the ladder. Was at this point any other, was there any indication that there was going to be any water flowing at, you know, corresponding? I know it's difficult with times and figuring things out, but was there any water flowing?
No. Engine 6, as I had said, just prior to the thermal event, they flowed a little bit of water, darkened it down, but the heat worsened, so they shut down because they had inefficient water, and they backed out. They actually backed out just before the event.
Okay.
So they got out before the actual fatal event. It occurred moments after they exited the Division 2 Delta door. So they had no water flowing other than that very brief burst of water that darkened it down in front of them.
Okay.
The only other water that flowed inside was what firefighter Dickman flowed as the event unfolded. Okay. And then he shut that down and attempted to bail toward Site Alpha. The officer, a point that I think is worth pointing out, as everybody was advancing, we don't believe that firefighter Dickman or firefighter Mashinsky noticed the open door on Site Delta, because that's about the point that they disappeared into the center of the room. And there was no indication that they saw the light from that door. So I don't believe they knew there was a door there. That's why firefighter Dickman went for the window. Okay. The officer from Engine 3, as he advanced up to the nozzle, he noticed a sliver of light to his right. He didn't know it was a door, but he knew there was something there, and he presumed it was a door. And when the event occurred at the nozzle, he yelled to both Dickman and Mashinsky to get to the door. Okay. And that's where he bailed to. It was an 8-second trip. He was able to dive out onto the landing, and then he transmitted two sets of his own maydays and indicated that the members were missing. Firefighter Mashinsky essentially was located where he was at the time of the event. He never transmitted anything over the radio. His microphone keyed up a couple times. We don't know if he was trying to transmit or if that was simply movement. But he essentially died right where he was.
Okay. Okay, so the event has taken place. The maydays have take us now to the RIT crews, the RIT activation, where they obviously went up those stairs. At this point, was it still a first alarm?
It was. And if you read, if you, or when you read the reports, you'll notice that through the RIT rescue, we never had any additional alarms transmitted.
Okay.
We operated, and that was one of our identified areas that we needed to improve on. The SOP as it was designed did not get activated. We operated with the RIT crew that was already on scene. That was a crew of four with a very experienced, competent officer. They were on scene. They had completed their RIT 360, which was at the time the only official 360 that was completed. That was the only crew at that time that was mandated to complete a 360. And they did, but one of the problems we identified was by the time they completed that 360, we already had crews committed.
Okay.
And we can talk more about the improvements later. But
yep.
The RIT team saw the rapidly deteriorating conditions. Actually, they heard the first two maydays. The initial incident commander did not hear the first mayday, brought it to the incident commander's attention. On the radio, it doesn't sound like the RIT crew was deployed immediately, but they did deploy immediately. And so as the RIT team is being deployed, there's another nearby company that's just completing an EMS run. And all of our members have portable radios, and we always, when we're on an EMS run or other incident, one crew member almost always keeps the radio on channel one to hear fires. They heard the call.
Okay.
They heard the mayday, and they self-assigned, knowing that we were going to need additional resources.
Okay.
And they were only a few blocks away anyway, so they end up arriving, and they end up becoming part of the RIT team. So to make it simple, what we did for RIT was part of the RIT team made entry over the ladder into the window where Engine 3 went in,
mm-hmm.
and the rest of the RIT team went up the stairs and made entry on Site Delta.
Okay.
And when they made entry, there was now some water being put on the fire from the outside on the Charlie Delta corner. As RIT went in, and if you see the raw video, news video that we have in our presentation, they entered, their efforts were nothing short of heroic, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
And in the opinion of everybody who's evaluated this. They basically entered under severe heat and smoke conditions, and basically what they did, the room was very, very cluttered. They did a very rapid primary search. They basically came together, met up in the room, and they basically did an unorthodox sweep of the room.
Okay.
Very rapid. And as they moved from...
Did they have a hose line with them at, or no?
Just the hose lines that were in the room.
Got it. Okay.
So no, initially, no. Okay. They utilized lines
right.
because they were charred.
Right.
They did a rapid sweep of the room. As I said, it was hoarder-like cluttered conditions.
Okay.
Zero visibility, extremely high heat. They were honestly scared for their lives as they advanced from Alpha to Charlie. They noticed the floor was, stability was deteriorating and was very spongy. When they got to Site Charlie, they actually missed both members on the first sweep, found the hole in the floor. And if you listen to the radio traffic, they called the IC and said, you know, you might want to check Division 1 because they thought maybe they fell through the hole.
Wow.
So they quickly determined that there was nobody on Division 1. They essentially regrouped, and a few minutes later, they found Firefighter Dickman up in the Alpha Bravo corner. He was removed.
Yeah, how long would you say time from the time that Rick made it in the room or was activated to they reported to command that they had the firefighter?
Well, the initial mayday was transmitted at 3:03 in the afternoon.
Okay.
Firefighter Dickman was located at 17 after.
Okay.
He was removed 2 minutes later at 19 after. And then, because we didn't have any additional resources responding, the RIT crew, now out of air, emotionally and physically drained, were forced to rapidly bottle back up and go back in for Firefighter Mashinsky.
Wow.
They went back in, and they found Firefighter Mashinsky at 27 after, and then he was removed in within 1 minute.
Okay.
15:28. That's when we did a scene light par and terminated the mayday.
Then after that, how long was it before the fire was called? Two questions I have. First one was that, okay, so then after that, when was the fire after the 27-minute mark, was the fire declared under control?
I would have to go back in the report and look at the benchmark, but I know that as they were doing the RIT search, we had the bulk of it. We had put a 2.5 in operation from the outside on the Charlie Delta corner, and Battalion 3, who was operating on Site Charlie, reported that the bulk of the majority of the fire had been knocked down.
Okay.
So we had essentially the main body of the fire knocked down by the time we found Firefighter Mashinsky.
Okay. The other question that I've always wondered is, and when you listen to the radio traffic, and again, there'll be links that we'll have to where you not only get the report, but some of the radio traffic. One of the truck companies was sent, you hear on the radio, was sent to do, I'm assuming, vertical vent. And they reported that they could not perform vertical vent. What was taking place? Was it just a smoke condition? Or explain to our listeners, because again, when you listen to the radio, they're sent, and then command asks them, basically to paraphrase, what's going on, and the company says, we're unable to do the vent. What stopped them, and what transpired there as far as opening the roof?
Yeah, so the primary reason, they never actually made the roof, and visibility was the reason they gave us. So when you look at the footprint of this incident from an aerial view, the wind speed and direction that day was coming out of the south-southwest, blowing north-northeast, and the truck was a tower ladder. It was placed off the Alpha Bravo corner as it was exactly downwind, and the smoke obscured them the majority of the time. There are several pictures in the presentation where you can't even see the ladder or the bucket.
Wow. Okay.
They got it elevated. And then as conditions deteriorated, we had a massive amount of smoke blowing directly in their faces. And essentially they were unable to move the ladder because they couldn't see.
Okay.
The assignment was vertical ventilation, but they never
right.
made it.
And okay, let's now, I want to talk a little bit about the internal reports findings. And
okay.
One of the ones I want to highlight for our, you know, our listeners is finding number three, and which is the incident commander's initial size up of the fire ground did not reveal the fire on Division One. Now, when we early on we talked about, you know, the building, and it was, you know, basically assumed that the fire was on Division Two, but all in all, what on that particular finding, what could have been, I mean, not the Monday morning quarterback, but what do you feel could have been a little bit different, or the reason why that finding was, you know, written there as far as that?
Okay, so I think the first important thing to note in the fire building itself, Division One, it had one walk-in door, which was on Side Delta at the Charlie corner, mm-hmm. and no windows.
Okay.
So it was a cement block or a brick building, no windows on Division One. And again, on arrival, all the smoke that they saw was coming from Division Two. Everybody corroborated that story.
Okay.
So on this particular day, we did not have a standardized size up approach to buildings. We essentially looked at what we saw and reacted to what we saw.
Okay.
And applied our tactics based on what we saw. What could have been done differently?
Now I'm gonna ask you, that's a great, say that again, because I think, Chief, all of us are like that, and many fire departments are like that. But when you say you reacted to what you saw, you know, I think that's basically most fire departments in America. Would you not agree? I mean, especially an urban, busy department like yours, that's always worked. Would you, I mean, with your experience and your, you know, your fire ground experience, would you tend to agree with that statement? In the past, it always worked, correct?
Absolutely. The majority of the time it did. We are a busy department. We do, you know, our bread and butter fire is the single family residential house fire.
Mm-hmm.
We go to those all the time. And that is what I think we are really good at the majority of the time. And we have never had, as I stated, we've never had a standardized approach to size up. We've okay. arrived, you know, we've looked at the building. We look at the conditions coming out of the building, and that's what we react to.
Okay.
And for years, we were almost always a department that would, on a single-family residential house fire, make entry in the front door.
Sure.
And we've always prided ourselves on being an aggressive interior attack fire department. We pride ourselves on getting water on the fire quickly. We think that we win with water, and the faster we get water on the fire, the faster everything improves. Our search efforts are as aggressive. We've honed our oriented person search techniques to great efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And what we haven't been good at, and I think is very prominent, as you said, throughout the fire service, is when we arrive at what we had this day was the absolute opposite of our bread and butter fire. We had what this was a high risk, low frequency building. And then we chose, after the initial dead end of going into an apartment that led to nowhere, we chose a high-risk, low-frequency tactic for us, which is going in the building through a window over a ladder.
Right.
That's high-risk, low-frequency. We just don't do that normally.
Right. You know.
And then we did it under the additional stress and pressure of arriving late due to the longer response.
Right.
And the stress of the report of people trapped in the building.
We
get into that smoke, fire, goal mentality, and that's what we did here, but with the goal of saving lives and it
right. is. Would it be fair to say that one of the classes that I have taught at FDIC and I teach around the area and the country in the past is what's called, instead of a big military history person, and you hear of being lost in the fog of war, and I had changed. Absolutely. My class is called, you know, Lost in the Fog of the Fire Ground. And I think that firefighters, not just what took place, unfortunately, in your city, but as a whole, we firefighters, are they get lost in that fog of the fire ground, that there are certain things that transpire on the fire ground that we just kind of, we gravitate and we go and we don't think about. And you're right. I think that, you know, I'm trying to think how many times I don't think any of the times in my career, we took a initial hose line up a ladder. Now that's not saying you can't, but what this fire has taught me that I have shared is that if you do that, your antenna's got to be raised and it has to be, like you said, a high risk, low frequency event.
Absolutely. It has to be recognized as such before we ever step off the rig.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's part of the lesson learned here. And we've incorporated that into our first new fire ground size up program that we've implemented since then. Because you can't, the bottom line is we cannot approach a high risk, low frequency building with a residential mindset.
Right.
We've all heard that a million times, and it's easier. It's very, very easy to sit in a classroom and say that. And it's very, very difficult to apply that in the stress of a moment like we experienced that Sunday.
Yeah. And it's good to hear it. I'm sure you may have seen it, but on YouTube, and I use it in my class. And for our listeners, in 1999, I'm sure most in the fire service know, even if you weren't on the job then, the tragedy that took place in Worcester, Massachusetts, and where six firefighters died. And there was, and there still is, you can find it on YouTube, one of a fire service, I believe, a mentor that I look up to, I've never met the man, but Mike McNamee, who was a chief there on scene that night in Worcester. But he said that in this YouTube video you can find, that he says, you know, in Worcester, they are perfect at the three-decker fire, that is their bread and butter fire. And that they approach that same mindset to the Worcester cold storage building, and that you absolutely cannot do that when it comes to a commercial building, that your antenna, the hair on the back of your neck, basically, to quote him in this video, says, you know, should stand up on. And that is, I think, a very good reminder. And what I'm glad that this podcast, we're able to have this podcast, to anybody listening, that when you have a commercial building fire, especially in a type 3 ordinary constructed building that pretty sturdy, that you are going into to an offensive mode with, you, the hair on the back of your neck has to stand up, and you have to think a little bit about the differences than your, like you said, a bread and butter bedroom fire in a 2.5-story wood frame building. And I hope that in the fire service that becomes, I think we get lost in all the things in the fire service nowadays, that all, there's so many things, whether it's social media thrown at us or whatever, that we forget about these things, and we forget about it, and we're constantly getting lost in that fog of the fire ground, Chief.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And on all hazards department like ourselves, we have the fog of war constantly, and that was certainly present on Magnolia. We have, being an all hazards department, we have incredible amount of training demands on us. And that trying to be at least efficient, if not proficient, at all of our skills, it's hard to maintain a constant focus on the core competencies of our primary mission of fire suppression and rescue. I think we are doing a much better job of that now, but it, you know, with everything else that we have to do, it is a constant struggle to get the message, the right messages out on a consistent basis.
What one of the other things that I caught in reading the report, you read it, but when you talk about it, it really struck me again, is you had some younger members and on the job at that time.
Yep.
In your mind, in your experience, you know, we all go through phases in our careers. Right now, in my department we're going through. You know, we have younger officers, younger firefighters, less experience. And on Magnolia Street, would you say that, I don't want to say that it affected or caused any issues, but you had mentioned the pump operator. Where is Toledo gone from that incident as far as training younger members? Because let's be honest, we can say all we want, we're still going to have fires where we have younger members in positions where, you know, they have great responsibility, and we don't have enough staffing anymore in fire departments to where you can hide them or babysit them 24/7. So just kind of curious, in a city like yours, where that has gone as far as younger members in the training.
Well, you know, that was one of the, I'll just call it a factor there that day. We had, as I recall it, 26 members dispatched on the initial alarm. Of those 26, 10 had 13 months or less of experience. And you're right. In a department our size, with the attrition rates that we have, for example, when I came on this department, I came in a class of 61. That's a large group. And, you know, theoretically, 25 years later, those 61 people can all retire on the same day.
Right.
And creating a large gap in our staffing. And we have that issue. One of the reasons so many rookies were on this alarm was that very fact. We have an attrition rate here that is increasing every year, especially mm-hmm. with our deferred retirement option program that's going on.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, we're hiring a class here in a month or so of at least 47, and then another one next year. We have a high turnover rate due to attrition, and that makes us a very young department very, very quickly. And the daily challenge here to cover 19 stations in our city is to balance that. And when the numbers start to tilt towards more young than old, it's a very, very challenging task. And we do our very best every day to balance that out to the best of our ability based on who's working. And you have to take into consideration days off and whatnot.
Sure.
And that stepped up. That effort has stepped up. It was, you know, it was there then, but we're more focused now than ever.
On
balancing that.
What in the days after, you know, obviously a terrible tragedy. Let's take our listeners through what you personally, you know, your roles in the days after the Toledo Fire Department, I guess, as a whole, you know, how did you go from where this took place to where you are today? If you could briefly touch on how the department has changed and from the hours after the event to, you know, today.
Sure. I can tell you that when this occurred, it was, I would safely say, from the chief on down, probably the furthest thing from our radar. You know, we're a big, busy department, 525 members. There were many, many of us. You know, honestly, we had not had a fireground line of duty death here in the previous 45 years. So from the chief on down, none of us had experienced a fireground line of duty death. We had a line of duty death in the engine house, and that is equally tragic, but different circumstances.
Sure, sure.
When this hit, it wasn't obviously one, it was two. We were all but completely unprepared. None of us had ever experienced it. This is not something that anyone wants to think about or plan for. And we were essentially all but totally unprepared for this to happen. So when it did, quite frankly, it flipped our ship upside down.
Sure.
This was the deepest, most painful, devastating event any of us had ever experienced from the fire ground. And because really one of the only pieces that we had was our members were required to annually update a serious injury line of duty death notification form.
Mm-hmm.
That was in place. That was really the only significant piece that was in place on this day. And thankfully it was. It helped with the notifications. But we were totally unprepared. It was devastating from the chief on down, and it derailed, I think, the entire mindset and operation of the department for a long, long time. I have to give credit to our members, because the one thing that didn't derail was the service to our citizens. Mm-hmm. As devastating as this was, I mean, this is absolutely as devastating as losing a blood family member, for sure. But what I'm most proud of is the fact that from the moment we all found out on that day, through the following months and years, we never faltered in our response to the citizens we serve. That there was never a gap in service, and our members, I believe, performed above and beyond in the midst of this tragedy.
That's, for sure. Where are you at today in 2019?
Today, we are definitely back on the track. We have made tremendous progress in recovering from this. We recognize that this will never be behind us. What you have to do with something like this is find a place for it and put it there, but it's always right below the surface. But we, from the moment this happened, and once we got the criminal trial out of the way, especially, we dedicated ourselves to completely tearing ourselves apart and looking in the respect that we, and I don't mean tearing us apart as a group, but tearing down everything, looking at every single aspect of our operations. We dedicated ourselves to do a very thorough, deep dive look at everything we do, from every single SOP to how we train to, and then identified through this report and investigation, which took the internal team 8 months to complete. And we worked side by side with NIOSH and all of the other cause and origin investigators. And once we identified the areas that we needed to improve, we developed command or leadership priorities. And we've developed a lot of programs to overcome the areas of weakness in this event. I can get really specific.
I guess one of the things that I'm big on is, let's go to the command level. Where were you as far as command? Like, I understand, and for our listeners, Toledo runs 3 battalions, and they have basically, you don't really have a citywide boss. You have like the senior battalion on duty is kind of takes that, correct? As far as the 3
correct. Yes, and that senior battalion obviously reports to the chief of operations, who is not a 24/7 position, right, but is always there and listening and available.
Where, as far as command and control, the lessons and where, what changes that Toledo has gone through in their command and control of these events from Magnolia Street to 2019, and what you would recommend, you know, again, it doesn't matter size of department, but where you, the biggest learning points and maybe changes in command and control today.
Sure. One of the key things, and this, we had multiple, several programs that were under development prior to this incident, and we accelerated their development once this happened, because it played right into what we needed to improve. One of the very first things that we identified we needed to correct was we needed to standardize our size up approach. And we have what we call a first group fire ground size up class, quite simply. That focuses on standardizing our approach to every structure fire. And essentially, in a nutshell, what we do now is, and every single member has been trained, from the line firefighter to the battalion chief, is as when we approach any structure fire, that building is sized up from the foundation up.
Okay.
And we have now mandated that the first arriving company officer, first arriving BC, first arriving safety officer, and the RIT crew all do their own 360 size ups.
Okay.
And of course, if they can't be completed, then we assign a crew to get a look at Site Charlie and report back. But we've standardized that approach. We do foundation up. First thing we want to know is this building on a basement? Second thing we want to know is that basement on fire? And then the critical look on the 360 by those four initial members. And what we're hoping by, and I know that's those four 360s are very redundant, but what we believe is those four members doing their own 360s, we're hoping though that redundancy will catch rapidly deteriorating conditions in time enough for us to get out of the way. And that's working really well for us.
As far as command, I'm going to ask you this question. I'm just going to say it because I just can't envision it. To me, I don't think three command battalion command chiefs is enough for a city the size of Toledo. I guess in your eyes, has Toledo done anything as far as getting more battalion chiefs or command level officers? Maybe not in the mix. I don't want to go into that. You know, that kind of thing, but on scene. So of the three battalions, are you trying to get, additional battalions responding? Because I think that's one of the issues that we face in the fire service today is that I think we need to command a working commercial building fire, or even an advanced larger structure fire in a residence. You need more than one command level officer on scene to assist you. Just, I think that you can't think that a single guy holding a portable in the front of a main street can run a fire in a commercial building. I just don't see it anymore. It's not a slam on anyone. I just don't think that in 2019, that is the proper way to go. And I was just curious if Toledo has done anything or is working towards maybe getting more command level officers on scene of these kind of events.
Well, I will answer that in this way. Like every other municipality, we have budgetary issues.
Sure.
Everybody does.
Yep.
And like everybody else, we've always been expected to do more with less. What we are actively doing is we are still in the process of getting four members on every piece of fire apparatus. Okay. We have identified that as a very major priority. We want to get, because we have rigs that only have, like our truck companies, mm-hmm. have three members. We're trying to get four personnel on every fire suppression rig. We're actively doing that now. I think I can speak for everybody in our command staff here. Do we agree with you that we need to build command teams quickly, and that a single IC is extremely challenged managing even the single family residential house fire? Absolutely. Yeah. Would we like to have command aides? Would we like to have two, if not three, chiefs on the scene of commercial structure fires on a first alarm assignment? Absolutely. Are we actively going after that at this point? Not yet, because we've identified our priority to be, let's get four firefighters on every suppression.
As
rate.
It should. Yeah, I agree with that.
Make those hands-on operations safer. Yeah. Will we ever realize what you and I certainly agree on is ideal? I'm not sure because of the budgetary issues that we consistently face.
Sure.
But we certainly agree that needs to happen, and that is the safest way to go and operate for sure. And I hate it. It grinds me to have to say that is not a reality here, and it's largely budgetary.
As we're wrapping up here, I ask you, Toledo, I'll give you major props because as a student of the fire service, I see that, there are some line of duty deaths where I don't want to say it's swept under the rug, but they don't want to talk about it. And and sure, there's a NIOSH report, and that's it. And it's never really discussed, and it's never. So I applaud you to have, and Toledo Fire, to have the courage. Was there ever a time, however, where that was, you guys had any doubts as far as exposing, I guess if that's a word, I again applaud you. I wish every department, you know, we never want to see a line of duty death, but again, in my opinion, what Toledo has done, what several other fire departments have done as far as having an internal report disseminated to the world, I commend you. And it takes courage.
Thank you.
It takes courage. And it makes the fire service better. Was there ever any doubts or any kind of conflict in Toledo to do this? Or just kind of curious on that standpoint. I'm glad.
Yeah, no. The simple answer is no. From the very, very beginning, once we identified areas that we could improve, we have always, I believe, it's been my experience that we have always been 100% committed not only to our own members, but to the fire service in general. And when we recognized the situation that we got into, which we commonly hear referred to what happened here as the perfect storm, a lot of things, little things, seemingly by themselves didn't mean a lot, when they came together, led to this tragedy. We were committed from the beginning to share what we learned and what we've done to improve our efforts to make sure this never happens again, because what we recognized is, and we have many people like myself who travel all over the country going to seminars and meeting our brothers and sisters, and what we've recognized is that this could happen to any of us.
Sure.
And if we can play a role in helping prevent that, somebody else from going through this, then we are 100% on board. You know what I want to say? That, as you know, there are many, many different ways to approach our incidents, many, many different ways to put out a fire, do an auto extrication, EMS care. And on this particular day, basically what we had was a very, very dedicated group of veterans, very capable and competent, rookies who, the bottom line is what we were doing is we responded to a call for a working apartment fire with a report of people trapped. And we responded with great focus, great dedication, the same sense of urgency that we always do. And when we arrived, we rapidly assessed it the way we were trained to. We immediately deployed with the sense of urgency that we had people to rescue. We went in and we do what we always do. We aggressively attacked the fire. We aggressively searched the building to save those occupants. Could we have done things better? I think you always can.
Sure.
One of the things we always ask our rookies is, or our veterans, to share in classes. Tell me the last perfect fire you've been to.
Right.
There is no such thing.
No.
And this was just a dedicated group of competent professionals who were doing the best they could in the situation they were in. And they did what they thought was best at the moment, in the moment. And even if you do things completely right, as you know, you can still have the same outcome.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
No, we were always going to share our story to anybody that wants to listen. And the programs that we've developed as a result of this, I have been sharing myself, along with a couple of others in our region. People seem to like the standardized approach we've taken, and we're happy to share that and grow from it together.
That said, as we wrap up here, Chief, how can our listeners get a hold of you if they would like to have you come to their department and discuss what took place there in depth?
Sure. Well, I am currently one of two battalion chiefs in our training bureau. My direct office number is area code 419-936-3526. And my department email address is Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, dot Benedum, B-E-N-A-D-U-M, at toledo.oh.gov.
And we'll have your contacts. Your contacts will be on the little introductory thing as far as when people play this podcast. Those contacts will be on Fire Engineering's Blog Talk Radio's introduction to this. So we'll make sure that those are there if people want to get a hold of you, Chief.
Awesome. And I can also, I can give you a cell phone number. That's 419-262-6348. And again, we are honored to provide any assistance we can to anybody who desires the interaction.
Chief, I want to thank you. And to our listeners, I'm going to close with this. If you listen to this podcast while you're on the elliptical or on the treadmill or working on something or whatever you're doing, this is leadership. There are many different things of what people want from a leader. But Chief Mike Benedum in the Toledo Fire Department is true fire service leadership in the fact that they want to say, hey, we had an issue. We had a fire. It was the perfect storm. And we want you to learn from it. And Chief, I want to thank you. I encourage our listeners to reach out to Toledo Fire, to have these gentlemen from Toledo Fire come to your fire department to talk to you. Chief, thank you. I appreciate it. And to our listeners, that wraps this up. I want you to, again, if you want to reach out to Chief Benedum, this contact information will be on there. But please read the internal report, read the NIOSH report, look at some video, Google this event, and take it back to your departments and learn from it.